Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
As has been true recently, we're pre-taping shows that can be run while I'm off on a honeymoon, and Munchkin is making a movie in Texas. Our guest tonight is Rick Night Train Blaine. We'll be talking about his new book, Blackjack Blueprint, subtitled How to Play Like a Pro Part-Time. Rick Blaine is a career executive with a Fortune 500 company, and has played blackjack both solo and as part of a team for more than 25 years. His works are especially recommended for beginners. Rick Blaine, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you for having me, gentlemen. You guys have a great show. It's both entertaining and educational. Before we get started, Munchkin, you're there, right?
Yes, I'm here.
I got a question for Munchkin before you guys get into me. I want to know when you're going to tell me where the secret game is. I mean, come on. You know, when that guy told me about that thing a couple of years ago, I told you, and now you can't tell me about this thing?
Yeah, on the air. Good thing nobody's listening to the show, so nobody else would hear.
The Manhattan Project. Okay. Well, you know, I totally understand that, you know, Munchkin, you get you're privy to all the top grade games. You've always had a solid reputation, and I've had the privilege of playing with you, and from my experience, you certainly live up to that rep. So I guess when there's an opportunity to send off a top player to capitalize on a situation, you're certainly one of the individuals that folks seek out.
Well, thank you for that, but we're here to pump you up, not me. So
all right, I'll give you a book.
Yeah, and silly me, I actually thought Munchkin was in Texas making a movie. Now I didn't know he was off to a secret game. Wow, he surprised me.
Kind of tricky.
All right, now Rick, you have two previous books, including one that is also called Blackjack Blueprint. How is the current book similar to? And how is it different from the previous two books?
Okay, well, the first Blackjack Blueprint was published in 2000, and it was a 45-page booklet strictly on how to operate a blackjack team. Earlier that year, I also wrote a booklet titled Blackjack in the Zone, which was geared towards players who already knew how to count cards. And it focused on what could be useful to a player once hitting the tables with the necessary technical skills. But then in 2002, I expanded the material on Blackjack in the Zone to include a section on an actual learning method that could be applicable to learning just about any count system. I didn't feel it was necessary to include one specific count system in there, because there's so many on the market back then and now even more. And but a learning method, I put together a method where someone could really sit down, practice, learn, and get to the tables that much quicker. Eventually, I merged the material in both booklets, added some additional sections for beginners on how to learn the basics, and some more advanced techniques for your seasoned player. And I threw in a few war stories, and that gave us a little over 300-some-odd pages for the existing Blackjack Blueprint paperback, How to Play Like a Pro Part-Time, which came out in 2006. That's, you know, 8 years ago, and a lot's happened in the advantage playing world since then. So there's room for more material, and that's what I decided to come up with and throw in some more information in an updated edition.
So what are the extra chapters in the new version?
In the new version, there's a chapter on information on how to hide chips and disguise wins. I thought that was a useful topic to cover because people ask and they say, what's the best form of camouflage to make yourself? And the answer really is losing. But we're not there to lose, but creating the illusion that we're a losing player could be very helpful in the eyes in throwing off the casino. So how to disguise your wins and make it difficult for the casino to keep an accurate read on how many chips you're leaving the table with, I thought was a valuable section. Another section I put in was on sort of an advanced comps section, more on airfare reimbursement, how when you get into play at a higher level, how that comes into play as far as cutting down on your expenses, and that could be a very useful method to use to really help your maximize your profit. And what I think, in my opinion, the most useful section that I've added in there is one on privacy protection. That I took more or less my years in the financial industry, and we all know today we're in an era where businesses, it's just all about trying to gather as much information about us as consumers as possible and use it for whatever reasons, for marketing or just for their own know-your-customer strategies. And I felt, especially with the casino industry, who are very notorious for collecting personal information, I thought it would be very important and useful for players to know how to develop strategies to help minimize their exposure of where the casinos are getting their personal information.
Certainly very important, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And one other section I put in there was about loss rebate strategies. Originally, I was very hesitant to publish this material, and because I've used this, and a lot of people I know, I shouldn't say a lot, a few people I know have used this very successfully. And recently, there was a gentleman who slammed some Atlantic City casinos, and he went public about the methods he used, which are very similar to what I've used in the past. And I said, well, the cat's out of the bag now, so may as well just publish it.
Yeah, that was Don Johnson. He's been on our show.
Oh, correct. Yes, yes. He did very well. It was very impressive what he did.
And some of it was actually using loss rebates.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of it was really using loss rebates. Yeah, I have to say, Rick, that I hadn't read the book in 8 years or whatever since the first version came out, and I read it again, and it really is now the book that I recommend for new players to start with. I think all the drills for learning basic strategy and learning how to count and all that are really great. I think it's a really great way for a guy to start out learning. And the other thing that I like about it is if a new player reads the book, they're going to get into all this kind of advanced stuff that it's not something they're going to need to learn now, but after they become a competent card counter, it's something for them to go back to the book and then look at those things. And the book does not really cover them in depth, but it gives a player a starting point for, you know, some more advanced ways of thinking, you know?
Yeah, it's I tried to cover as many methods of advanced play as I could within reason. And it was a similar thing. I mean, card counting, of course, that's sort of the most popular method of advantage play at the game of 21. And, I mean, I've heard about shuffle tracking for a while, and I never got into it until maybe like the late 1990s. And I just, I did it, and I learned how to do it. I had some good help, some people that were really masterful at the art of shuffle tracking, and it does work. In today's environment, you have to seek out the trackable shuffles, but I'm sorry.
Well, I was, my contention is that for someone to try to learn it now is pretty much a waste of time, because I don't think there are really many shuffles worth exploiting. Definitely for a beginning shuffle tracker, I would never tell them to go in try to beat one of the Vegas shuffles. I mean, they're just terrible for shuffle trackers.
Yeah, nowadays they've really changed. The shuffles have gotten more complex over the years. It's a good skill. I mean, I agree with you. It's a good, it's not something you want to just send a beginning player out there. Okay, you're going to learn how to shuffle track. Go out there and hit the shuffles. No, it is a waste of time. But to have that in your toolbox, those skills, and you happen to be somewhere and you see, wow, this is a shuffle that has a weakness, to be able to exploit that and profit from it, it's a good skill to have. It's not something I would suggest for people to seek out, but I wanted to cover as many realistic methods that I could, just from an introductory level in the book.
Yeah, I agree. It's a good tool to have in your box. When I get asked this question a lot, should I learn to shuffle track? And what I ask players when they ask me that is, of the casinos that are around you that you frequent, what are the shuffles? Describe the shuffles to me. And when they describe them, they're always these two pass garbage, And I say, no, it's a waste of time. Now if you live in Bahrain and they have casinos that, are simple, one pass, break it in half and shuffle it down. Well, then yeah, you should learn to shuffle track.
Yeah,
And Bahrain is not the secret game, by the way.
Oh, we already know it's in Texas.
Me off track over there.
Yeah, we already know it's in Texas, although most of us thought there's no casinos
in
Texas.
I'm getting my plane ticket right now.
All right. Texas isn't very big. You should be able to find it quickly.
I have to say very quickly, I had a friend who was always obsessed with the secret game, and I remember him one time coming to me. We were living in Vegas, and he came to me all excited, and he was like, I just saw Matt. This was summer in Vegas. I just saw Matt, and he was buying a sweater, as if, this was some clue to where the secret game was, Mm-hmm. It's 100 degrees in Vegas, and the guy was buying a sweater. So I was like, what, are we supposed to follow him?
That's always like a tip-off. If you happen to be somewhere, some far-distance place, and you're playing, and then all of a sudden you see a few, one player there that you know, and then there's another player that you realize, wait a second, something's going on.
Right, right.
But don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
You spend a lot of time in the book on team play.
Yes.
You include more stories about team play that went badly than stories about team play that went well.
Yes.
Considering forming or joining a team may well get very discouraged by this. Was this intentional?
Yes, it was. Absolutely. Over the years, I've gotten the impression that there are quite a few folks out there that think joining a blackjack team is an instant road to riches. And overall, my experiences with team play have been successful. When a team is winning, it's great. But the true test of the cohesion of a team is during the losing times. And you will experience those on a team. I mean, it's not instant. It's not where you're guaranteed to win. There are more things that could go wrong with a team than could go right. And it's just a matter of fusing together the good, the right, and the positives to really get a team to work well. So I wanted to point out, I didn't want to just say, hey, great, this is the way to do it, because there isn't any one, you know, sort of magic bullet for it.
Yeah, I wanted to say this is another one of the things that I really liked about the book is you really nail a lot of the pitfalls of team play. And but one thing that I thought maybe you were just being too politically correct. You described one team where, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys were losing after over 1,000 hours of play. That's correct, right? And two of the players really were the ones losing. And anyway, my point was, you know, if a team is losing, or even an individual, after 1,000 hours of play, either somebody is stealing or they're not competent, right? I mean, that no longer is in the realm of fluctuation. And it seemed to me, the way you described it in the book, that you didn't think they were stealing. I mean, one of the guys got polygraphed, I think.
Yeah, we did polygraph, I think, both. If I'm remembering correctly, we polygraphed both the players, and they came up clean. So stealing.
Now, what is your feeling about polygraphs?
They're not foolproof. I mean, people. There's a lot of methods out there to beat a polygraph.
I think they're worthless
on a team or in any business. A polygraph is more of a deterrent than anything else. To have total reliance on the results of a polygraph is, I think, you know, it's a bit naive in some senses. But the fact, you know, there are players that would say, okay, well, how many have polygraphed? What else are they doing? And people might have a tendency to think twice before they want to try anything underhanded.
You know, I think basically the polygraphs are worthless. You're right. There may be some deterrent effect. On the early teams that I played on, they all had a rule that any player could request a polygraph of any other player at any time. And, you know, I know of several polygraph situations where I just did not believe the polygraph, you know, after it had happened. So.
Yeah.
We did have one interesting story. We had one guy who was losing way, way, way more than what seemed possible given our structure, how much he was supposed to be betting at what advantage. And he was down in the islands, and we flew him. I think he was down over $100,000 personally. And I forget, maybe our top bet was two hands of a thousand maybe, or maybe even less than that.
Well,
and anyway, we flew him back to Vegas and gave him a polygraph. And basically he told 100% the truth, but he told us, well, yes, I'm betting much more than we're supposed to. Yes, I'm playing cover that I'm not supposed to by betting big off the top. Yes, I'm drinking when I play, but I can handle it. You know, yes, I'm tipping way more than what it says, but we can afford it. You know, and so he didn't lie, but he certainly told us all the things he was doing that were completely against, you know, the
rules. He wasn't following
procedures. Yeah. So
I'm not lying, now, but yes, I'm stealing.
Well, he wasn't stealing. Yeah. He was just following the rules.
Yeah, someone could pass a polygraph test and say, yes, I was taking money.
Well, yeah.
If you look
but
at that
now,
way.
Looking back on it, looking back on that team, do you now think that those people were stealing, or do you think they were not competent? Or is your head in the clouds?
I haven't really looked back at that, reflected back at that in a long time. But when you have a team that's losing, you always wonder why, you know, what really did happen. Knowing the players, I don't think they were stealing. I think perhaps maybe game selection might have been a factor there.
So playing bad games in order to get in a lot of hours.
That was one of the things I've experienced that, not particularly with that team, but I have experienced that in the past. And one of the things that I thought is a good thing. I know there was one particular team that played and was very, very successful in the 1990s. And what they did was they had organized trips where all their players would be in Vegas or Mississippi or in Atlantic City or wherever the games were. They were all in the same place at the same time, and that was the trip. They ended the trip. Here's the results, and on to the next trip. What I found, things started falling apart when my teams started going away from that model, where everybody was sort of going off on their own into different places, because you run into several problems. One, you know, there's no real built-in monitoring of, let me see what this guy is doing. And
right.
Two, with money transfers, you get a player, they run short on bankroll. I have to wire money, someone has to fly over and drop off cash, whereas if you have the whole team in one place, someone's got money.
Yeah, I know of a team that basically always has two players at the table. No one ever plays alone, so that if stealing is going on, it would have to be two guys who conspire to do it together, which I think really lessens the,
sure,
you know, lessens it. My experience with teams is whenever I was involved with a team that was just sort of loose associates, it just did nowhere near as well as they should have. But I was on some very, very successful teams, but they were always with people who really were kind of close friends. Mm-hmm. You know, those teams did much better than the ones where we all just kind of knew each other. And I was on, were you on that team that the name of the team was Craps?
No, I was not.
In the 90s, were you on that team?
No, I did not. I was not involved. I came,
okay.
Actually, after that team disbanded, I was, you know, there was some consideration about.
I was just going to say, I thought you were involved in some way in that team. But anyway, the problem with that team, which again was one of these where people were just kind of associates, was there really was no strong management. You know what I mean? There was nobody really in charge. So everybody was just kind of off doing whatever they wanted to do. And Arnold wrote a lot about that team, and it was a team that lost money. And really a lot of the problem with that was the expenses. You know, and it's something that really has to be defined well on teams is what is an expense? Because that's really, I think that team made money, but after expenses it ended up minus.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with that also. Basically, we won at the tables, but then after expenses, we were in the red, and it just it doesn't make sense. You really have to plan for that. What I found,
well, especially
one of the things,
foreign play is tremendously expensive. Not only with the airfares, but usually you're not being comped into a
hotel.
You're
not getting comp, and you got your meals. So I mean, there are a lot of things where, and again, if you, I think the team that in the 90s that played with the model is we're only going to have trips where we have X amount of players present and play as a group in the same place. If a team travels to a foreign location where there's this great game or games, the thing to do is rent a place. Everybody's housed together. You're cutting down on your hotel expenses. You're cutting down on your meals, provided someone could cook. And it really that could make the difference between a winning trip and a losing trip when it comes down to it.
It's hard to prove that you don't know each other in the casino if you all go back to the same house.
Well, yeah, it depends where you're. If there's a limited number of casinos in the particular town or city you're playing, then it gets a little tricky. I mean, you know, the biggest challenge is when you have a foreign casino and all of a sudden a group of Americans start invading the place. They catch on very quickly.
I bet they do. Yeah. Now, the subtitle of your book is How to Play Like a Pro Part-Time. The part-time aspect is a very, very small part of the book. How would the book's information be different if you were looking to play blackjack full-time?
Well, this is actually a question I've been asked on many occasions. And there are some significant contrasts between a full-time professional player and a part-time. So for those of us with traditional full-time jobs, we get a regular paycheck and we have that sense of security. Part-time blackjack, for me at least, has been a supplementary source of income where I exercise care not to make any careless financial risks. And I think that was very sort of a balanced way of playing, a balanced approach to the game. On the other hand, I had to wake up every morning. I had to put on a suit. I had to go into my office and attack the daily grind of a full-time gig. While a full-time blackjack player could basically create his or her own hours, dress more casually in most cases, and basically you're your own boss, unless, of course, you're playing for a team. But still, even then, it's a lot more of a... for someone that doesn't want a structured work life, they fit in for a full-time as a full-time blackjack player. That's just, you know, you're just your general makeup as an individual. And it really does take a special type of person to do this full-time. And, you know, as far as writing about playing full-time, since I've never actually played full-time, I really don't feel as though I'm qualified as an authority to write about that. I mean, I could give my opinions, which I do, but it wouldn't be fair to the reader if I would just talk with authority and say, okay, to play full-time blackjack, here's what you have to do, because I haven't really lived it. There are some successful full-time players out there. They are uniquely talented individuals who have taken the calculated risks and worked very hard at honing their skills. I mean, I've read some material of such players, but I think there could be more, because it is interesting to compare the overall lifestyles of a full-time player versus someone who plays part-time on a professional level playing part-time, which is what I've done.
So, you know, even when I've, not had other jobs, I think my play looked more like part-time, because I've always played in fits and spurts. Even though I may not be working at any other job, I was never out playing, 250 days a year or whatever. I would take a trip and maybe I'd go somewhere for 10 days at a time, or maybe it would only be 4 days or whatever. But, I guess I'm saying that even when I was full time, I really was part time.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach. I mean, it's a more it's a bit more of a conservative approach versus what I've for pl- players that do play full-time that I've spoken to, their approach to the game. I mean, they feel as though, okay, it's Monday, here's the start of the week, here's what I need to do this week or this month in order to pay the rent.
Oh, well, and that's a recipe for disaster.
yeah, that's, some players have been successful at that, but it's, you know, you have to be a unique, it takes a unique person to really have that approach. I've known people, they just say, okay, I'm moving to Las Vegas and here's what I'm doing. And, you know, they work in the comp system, they're working every angle, and Bob, I'm sure you get a kick out of this one, is most of these people that go out there trying to be blackjack players have ended up playing video poker.
There's a lot of video poker players who used to be blackjack. One of them's talking on the radio right now. But,
okay.
But it's there's different skills. There's different personalities.
Yeah.
And we'll have that conversation some other time. One of the things I got out of it is it true that the difference between a part-time player and a full-time player is full-time players know where the secret game is? Is that basically what you're saying?
It depends on the full-time
player.
I don't like Munchkin. Munchkin knows where the Munchkin is one of the first people that will find out about the game. He just never tells me.
Okay.
I don't blame him either.
All right.
Actually, I have to say, Rick was one of the people who got me involved in a particular. There's another guy. I want to give him credit. I don't want to say his name, but because he's probably listening, and he's like, "What do you mean? I'm the one who." But anyway, we made a trip together to Puerto Rico, had a lot of fun. But that model I thought was really interesting because you approached me and this other guy and said, "We have found games, and we're willing to send you and pay you a percentage of EV, And I thought actually that was a great model because I was being sent to games that I didn't know about, I wouldn't have known about, So it was good for me and it was good for them. And I thought that was a really kind of interesting way to go. You know, it's also dangerous because the guy, the investor, I thought, was... It was very easy for him to be taken advantage of.
For some reason, he must have trusted you.
Yeah, well, that was an interesting model because it wasn't, it was a large bankroll and...
it wasn't really a team.
What's that?
It wasn't really a team.
No, it wasn't a team in the traditional sense. It was just a handful of, a group of players, maybe between 7 and 10 of us, who had experience playing at those stakes, who could pull it off, and who had a reputation, could be trusted. And the individual who was basically calling the shots had the access of information to these games, and we hit them. It was an interesting model. I thought. I wish it could have. It really didn't go as far as it could have. It had a lot of potential, but it ended before it really got a chance to really start rolling.
Yeah, I came in, I think, at the very end, because I only made one trip.
All right, Rick, do you have any stories of interesting things that have happened to you in a casino, maybe where you ran into somebody else from another team or another counter, something like that?
Yeah, there are times, you're like, if you're somewhere, you're on a trip, and... for some reason, whenever I was in Lake Tahoe, I would always run into someone there because I like to ski. So Lake Tahoe was a place where I would I'd go in the winter. I'd get some skiing in. And at the time, the casinos there was Harrah's, there was Caesars. they had some pretty decent games, and you could play for moderate stakes there, and as long
and,
as you didn't...
And you could walk to the ski lifts from
yeah,
those
basically. It was great. It was great. And, I mean, there were occasions there I was there, and I usually there's someone else I'd run into because there were a few other players that just liked to ski and just so happened to be there at the same time I was. And in these situations, it was with folks that I knew, and it was like, okay, listen, what time are you playing? All right, I'm still on East Coast time, so I'm up at 3 a.m. I'm going over there, and I'm playing in the morning a few hours. Then I have breakfast, and I'm going to hit in the slopes. So they go, oh well, I'm asleep by then. So I go, good. So we're not going to be stepping over each other. So that's usually that's a fun thing when you and then at least you could go somewhere and have dinner with the person if it's not too dangerous to be seen together in the casino. That's always a fun thing. But the most frustrating and sometimes thinking back humorous and dangerous thing is when you get someone you don't know, you're at a table and they sort of make you as a card counter. They see you're moving your bets. And they just all of a sudden they start twitching. They start doing these things with their hands, giving these little signals like, you know, the office and the sting hitting their nose, pulling their ears. It's like, you know, they're like all of a sudden become a third base coach giving signals like they're trying to, you know, or something. And it's you know, frustrating, dangerous, humorous. You know, you don't know this person. And then, you know, it was one occasion I went to the men's room and some guy comes over and he comes next to the urinal next to me and he starts talking to the side of his mouth, what system are you using? All this. And you just got to ignore these people and just, you know, because they could do you more harm than good.
But, yeah, I think that's an important lesson is, you know, don't approach other players in the casino. Don't, you know, I've said it on the radio many times, like, if you recognize me in a casino, do not come over and talk to me.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's foolish. I understand, you know, in what we do, it could be very lonely. I mean, if you're not playing on a team, you're starting off, how many people, when you go back home, you go back to your day job or whatever it may be, really could relate to what we're doing out there? And when, you know, some people that just have that need for that social element and they see someone that's doing what they're doing, they want to be your best friend, but that's the worst thing you could do. I mean, there's a time for everything, and that's not the time, and it's certainly not the place.
So when you were on various teams, did you ever have a situation where a team member lost a lot of money or had money stolen? I'm not talking about in the casino. I mean, like, they, I don't know, left it in a cab or got rolled in an alley. And if so, how did you deal with that?
I remember, I'm going way, way back, and this was not a team that I was running, but a player did come back and somehow didn't have the money that he reported. He was somewhat shy. It was a significant amount. I can't remember exactly. Somewhere maybe, over 1,000. And it was, first off, we're just counting the money over. I remember just counting the money over and over again, going over his results and trying to figure out, okay, well, something happened. And I remember I was there, and it wasn't my decision to make on anything, but I didn't think anything seemed fishy, but it just seemed very careless that this, you know, that everybody else was following a proper procedure, and everybody else was on the money, and this one person just came up, just, what happened? I don't remember.
When you were organizing teams, what was your policy if a guy, let's say a guy, you know, left $10,000 in the back of a cab accidentally? Did you have a policy regarding that?
No, we didn't. We did not. That's a very good point. We did, like, if someone...
Yeah, one of the things I try to... One of the things I try to tell people that are forming teams is that you want to try to think of every possible situation, scenario that can happen.
Yeah.
Because eventually something's going to happen that you didn't anticipate.
Yeah.
You know, and you want to think about as many different things as you can and talk about them at the beginning because it's always harder to make those decisions after it's already happened.
I do know that we had, I mean, if there was a situation where someone was robbed, that we would not, that person was not held liable for the amount that they were robbed. I mean, it goes the same thing. If you go into a casino and let's say you get popped and all of a sudden your chips are confiscated, you can't hold the player responsible for that. So, but then it creates problems because there's, if you have a team with a large team especially, there's going to be at least one person that's not trusting the word of the individual who was victimized.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get complaints back and forth, and it starts to ruin whatever cohesion you may have had before that.
We had a situation where a BP... basically after the play, he went and had a few drinks and he took a cab and he lost like $7,000 in the back of a cab, which we never got back. And, you know, our policy was, if you get robbed, we would look at that as a team loss. But in this particular case, we thought that the guy had been really irresponsible and basically said, you know, this is your loss. You know, you're responsible to make that up. But again, it would have been great if we had had a rule ahead of time saying, if you get drunk and lose your money, you know, it's on you.
It's like you said, you know, you try to cover every scenario, but there's always there'll be something that comes up that you never dreamed of happening. In our team rules and manual that I've had over the years, it specified, you know, what the things you're supposed to do to protect the bankroll when at the table, when leaving the table, when leaving the casino, when in your hotel room, when at home, when transferring to other players. But you know, as much as we try to cover everything, there's got to be something in there that will creep up and bite you in the butt, and it's like, gee, why didn't we think of this?
That was one thing I thought was. That you missed in the book was you talk about cashing out. And, you know, I think, you know, I've said before that the cashier's cage is the most dangerous place in the casino.
Sure.
And, you know, usually I tell people don't cash out after you play. You know, after a play is over, just leave. Leave with the chips. You can come back and cash them. You know, because there was heat on the play that you're not aware of, that's the place they're going to get the best photograph of you.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, most back-offs happen at the cashier's cage.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't cover that anywhere in the book. I'm surprised.
I don't remember.
It could be one of those things that I think about, we know, but I have to double check, because if I didn't, that is something that's so basic, really, that I should have in there. But yes, that is. They have the best cameras there, the best lighting, of course, and that's where they're going to get some great, great shots of you.
Some of those casinos now have those little cameras that are built that are in a little. On the surface of the cashier's cage, so they're shooting up at you. I've seen these now. So, you know, it's good to have a drink cup with you when you go to the to the cage, and make sure to set it down in front of those little cameras.
Sure. That's a good idea. I mean, they'll try everything there. But yes, what you said before, that's where most of the back offs happen, because the clock is ticking. you're there while you're still on the premises. You're there cashing the chips out. They've had a chance to further analyze your play, and they can say, okay, or to, you know, go through their database of photos and see, okay, here's this person, and, oh, there they are. They're at the cage. So that's, you know, certainly a place where you could get trapped.
Well, they can also hold you hostage. Once they have their hands on your chips, they can say, we want ID, and we're not giving the chips back unless you show us your ID. Or they can just say, wait a minute, and, you know, you're just stuck there at the cage.
You're helpless, basically.
Yeah.
When early in the book you've talked about practicing and getting ready to go into the casino, and then you actually do go in the casino and you're doing it, and you have some money management rules. You gave an example where you started, you had $1,200 in your pocket, and you planned over this trip to play 10 sessions. So you made it into $120 for 10 trips. And then you played until you either doubled your money or lost half of it, or you played an hour. I think that was the rule. So the most you could have lost was $600.
Okay.
And so if this is your strategy, then why on earth did you take $1,200 to start with if the most you can possibly lose is $600?
Yeah, the math really doesn't add up on that, does it?
So.
Well, they're really, you know, and that was included for the very, very casual player who wants to go out there and test the waters. And there is absolutely no mathematical justification for this, if you want to call it a strategy. I suggest bringing more money than necessary for this type of casual player for psychological reasons more than anything. You know, from my dealings with such casual players, I found that if one goes out and loses an entire bankroll, that individual's confidence is shot, and the player doesn't want to go back out and try again. So with this suggestion, you know, if a player gets clobbered, at least there's some money left in the pocket. And I guess in a way it's somewhat introducing a player to the, you know, the world of negative swings of the game without causing a total tap out the first time out of the starting gate. But, for the mathematically inclined, there's absolutely no justification on this. Why did I include it in there? It's just, you know, I guess just something to give, you know, just to give someone a method where you could go out there, all right, I want to play, and you have some, you know, you have that security blanket of that extra money behind you.
Yeah, although I would say, you know, if the guy is going out to for his first time to practice with $1,200, and you know, and he blows the whole thing on the first play, well, that guy probably shouldn't learn to count cards anyway. You know, maybe thinning the herd right at the beginning isn't such a bad thing.
Yeah. And I kind of have mixed feelings on that, because, you know, someone, it's a learning experience. You go out there and it's like, okay, gee, I did a lot of things wrong, and they want to learn and see, okay, hey, let me regroup, and you have the money to regroup with. But on the other hand, what you're saying is, okay, yeah, I really did have no business coming out there. So there's really no one set answer. But just from my discussions with people just coming out of the gate, it's just the biggest deterrent for them of getting back out there is just blowing their entire bankroll. They just,
I suspect a high percentage of successful gamblers today won on one of their first trips, and the ones who didn't win just said, this isn't for me, and they got out of there.
Yeah, yeah.
And exactly.
I definitely agree with that. I think people who just suffer a big negative fluctuation at the beginning, a lot of them just quit, and some who win right away continue, and some of them are not necessarily winning players. I especially think that's true in poker. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people take up poker. They win at the beginning, not because they're winning players, just because they happen to run lucky, and now they think they're winning players. Uh-huh. And later they end up blowing their money.
All right, Rick, we got about 5 minutes. Rick Blaine.
Oh, wow, time flies.
Rick Blaine happens to be the name of the Humphrey Bogart character in the movie Casablanca. Now, somehow, miraculously, it became the name that you write under as well. How did that all happen?
Well, I you certainly hit it right on the head. I had to select a pseudonym, and I figured let me pick a name that's really cool. And in my opinion, Bogey was the ultimate in cool. I mean, especially in the role of Rick Blaine in Casablanca. So I figured I'd snag that name. It's one of my favorite movies also, as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you also call yourself Night Train. Now, that's there's some musical songs called Night Train, including some very, very famous ones. Did that have anything to do with your...
He named himself after cheap wine.
Well, that was one thing, but actually, it came just something that clicked to me. There was a football player. He was a defensive back for the Detroit Lions. His name was Dickie Night Train Lane, and I figured, okay, Night Train Blaine had a similar ring to it. So I figured, let me just throw that in there.
All right.
And it was that's all there really was to it. There is a song. I mean, I know there's a Guns N' Roses song, Night Train, and I like Guns N' Roses. I actually had the privilege of hanging out with the band when they were touring back in 1992, and a bunch of wild guys.
Yes. Very good. All right. Your book is published by Huntington Press. So it is certainly available at shoplva.com. It's in both paperback and various ebook formats. Currently, if you go to amazon.com, you'll get the 2006 version in ebook. But since this show will air about a month after we're taping this, probably if you do it now, you'll get the 2014 if you go to amazon.com.
Is that true, Rick? Are they updating the Kindle version?
I believe so. I believe they are. It's supposed to be across the board, and
it only took Huntington Press 10 years to get my Kindle version out. So,
they're pretty active out there in Las Vegas. Pretty active publishing group, and I. I do have a note to give a call today to see what the status of when it's coming off the presses, because folks have been asking about it. But I'm looking forward. I enjoy writing, and it was. I'm glad I was able to contribute some new information, and I hope that it's helpful to players.
Thank you very much, Rick Blaine. His new book is called Blackjack Blueprint. Thank you very much, Richard Munchkin. I'm Bob Dancer. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody.
All right. Thank you for having me. And enjoy your honeymoon.
All right. Bob. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com. and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.